There we are. Just bursts through in all sorts of ways. Natasha, are you a cricket soul? I know you're a rugby soul, but are you interested in cricket, or is it just a case of what the hey, another strange activity?
It's more my sister's thing. She used to play for the Farndon youth cricket team, so I would go and watch her, but not personally for me. I'm not very sporty, I'm afraid.
Oh, I don't know. Let's move on, because in the studio, before we get the weather forecast for Lincoln from Newark, not Gibraltar this week, well, it's because of the A-level results, but we actually welcome back to the midweek drive. It's the awesome Sam Biggs. How are you, Sam?
I'm very well, Alex. Thank you very much for having me on the show again.
It's a delight to see you. Last night, as Tasha will attest to, Tasha graduated 2 years ago now, was it, Tasha, when you sort of left the University of Lincoln and sort of headed off first class productions?
So old.
Oh, Tasha, you know we don't use that word. We've become chronologically gifted or experientially enhanced. Tasha will attest to the fact that last night, Sam, we would have had great difficulty fitting you in. We had.
I heard it was a very busy show.
Seven people in the
people.
Exactly.
I didn't know you could fit seven people.
Exactly.
In the studio.
Well, this is it. Eight if you include myself. It's amazing. So we had to sort of squeeze it.
Fantastic.
But you're here now, and room to breathe, room to do all sorts of things. Tasha, would you like to find out why Sam's here and what his role within the University of Lincoln actually is?
Yes, Sam, tell us more about you.
So, yeah, I'm a postgraduate officer here at the university. I graduated 3 years ago, so it makes me feel old as well.
Well, you're even older than Natasha.
I'm here today. We've got an event on Saturday from 11 till 1 o'clock on campus. It's a postgraduate application event, so if you're thinking about postgraduate study, you've got an interest in joining, we're still accepting applications for September 2019. Then come along, I'll be heading up the event and you can find out everything to do with postgraduate.
And is that just for interested parties? You don't have to specifically have anything in mind. You actually think, oh, I quite fancy maybe doing some postgraduate stuff in all sorts
Absolutely,
of other areas.
Absolutely, yeah. And if you need any assistance with the application, student finance, any advice, help, anything to do.
Well, there we are, Tash. If you're free on Saturday, you could come back to your old university, because as the strapline goes and the posters around the campus will confirm, wherever you're from, your home when you come back to the University of Lincoln. So there we are. I roll that out there. Anyway, moving on. Natasha, the weather forecast for Lincoln, England, not from Gibraltar this week, but from Newark, Nottinghamshire, is...
Okay, so Lincoln is going to see some highs of 20 degrees and some lows of 11 degrees. It's going to be a day of sunny intervals and fresh breeze. So all things are rosy by the look of it.
Always, in every way.
Putting together an audio show which entertains and educates the globe is a piece of cake. When you've got the Midweek Drive and Midweek Drive Morning Edition teams on the case for Siren 107.3 FM and sirenonline.co.uk.
Excellent, as I say. Sorry, we're just having to sort through all manner of bits and pieces. We just want to progress now, because before we go to Richard Fitzwilliams, I think, Natasha, it's time we actually discuss a little bit with Sam what you've been doing since graduating, because you've been just crossing the continents in all sorts of ways, etc. So just talk us through your own little pathway since, as I say, you left with your degree in hand from the University of Lincoln.
Yeah, so I graduated in summer 2017. I applied to start with ECC, which was the English teaching company I went to Japan with, but the academic year in Japan doesn't actually start until April. It goes April to April, so I had to wait until February to go out there and do some training. So I did a little bit of temp work while I was waiting to go out, and then got out there, got my training, started teaching for 14 months. It was 18 month olds right through to 8-year-olds, all different class sizes. Traveled quite a bit up and down the length and breadth of the country, which was amazing. And then came back last kind of mid-April after I did some more traveling. And then I've been to New York, see my partner. I've been doing a little bit around Europe, seeing some friends and family. So I've just been traveling since a bit.
You see, that's just it's a passport to success from the University of Lincoln, really. Why could you actually ask? It's great stuff. From the Department of, really, are you serious about this? Apparently, you might test this with yourself, Sam, nearly half of British folk have never, ever visited any of the British Isles outside of mainland England.
quite a statistic.
Are you one of those folk?
I am one of those folk, unfortunately.
Now, because the next thing, 58%, again, over half of British folk couldn't actually point to the Isle of Wight on a map, despite it being the UK's most visited island. If I had a map here, would you be able to point to the Isle of Wight? You know roughly where it is.
Could be a tough call. Is it at the south of England?
Tasha, are you sort of holding the phone there thinking, Lord, it's all changed from that sort of point of view? But you know, we'll find out more about that from travel blogger and influencer Alice Teacake. Yeah, it's her real name. She's good, so is Alice. Simon Ewins is the managing director of Premier Inn. He'll be talking about that. Meanwhile, I know, Tasha, you normally were a midweek drive on the evening sort of package, but you did some morning editions, I think, and worked through that. I think you must have encountered Richard Fitzwilliams before. Or is that a case of no? I have no idea of who you're speaking of.
Oh, no, I remember Richard very, very vividly.
Yeah. Well,
he's a lovely, colourful soul, and I'm looking forward to speaking to him.
Exactly. Okay. We may just tease slightly ahead in terms of the sort of recent royal correspondent and how I was actually quite shocked and surprised that he seems to have had a bit of a gap, a lacuna, if you want to use a nice posh word, in terms of his recent royal coverage. We'll find out exactly what that might be after the boss. wonderful. Much, much, much better than the movie yesterday. And indeed, I have to say, if you're looking for a coming-of-age movie, which, of course, was bought by the person who actually launched the career of Keira Knightley, then you couldn't do better than actually check out the awesome nature of Blinded by the Light. But that's just my view, and in the end of the day, as Natasha will confirm, and indeed Sam in the studio, that doesn't matter a hill of beans when it comes to our awesome Richard Fitzwilliams, who is coming around in a few seconds after. Richard, I have to say, a little disappointed that as a royal correspondent you missed a major, major story this week.
Do tell me.
Yeah, as I was looking for the whole thing. Well, I mean, it was only the first official public engagement of the wonderful Carrie, the blessed wife of the glorious Emperor Boris. I mean, you know, she's out in public for the first time. And surely, if we're talking royalty, this is the serious thing. It's, forget, you know, the other sort of inhabitants.
I
mean,
I see what I forget them are, we. It's just for a moment. I was a little puzzled. I actually thought you'd discovered something that I had missed.
Well, exactly. I mean, surely, I mean, Natasha, the first public engagement. I mean, you're a royalist, Tasha. I mean, you know, clearly from that point of view, I mean, the Carrie Simmons making her first official appearance. I mean, that's awesome, isn't it?
I'm not sure I class her as royalty, but
But Boris does.
Royalty. She won't be going to Balmoral, I don't think. I said so in the Daily Mail. You can believe it.
Yeah. Well, what the hey? I mean, all that on a day where I see the tabloids have actually once again been sharpening their pens against the Sussexes and saying, you know, it's no good Prince Harry talking about climate change if you're going to be jetting off on private jets, etc., around over the world. But still. I don't know. It's a coarsening of our habit and world, etc.
How is a royal goldfish bowl? That's one of the problems. I mean, it always will be to some extent. I did think, I mean, I have to say that for a couple who guard their privacy, as Meghan and Harry do, I've got Vogue here, in fact, and I mean, I was interested in the way Meghan had guest editorship, or guest edited it, but there were aspects of it that did surprise me. They know very, I don't think, I mean, Diana was on the cover several times, Princess Anne was too, and so was Kate. So I don't think that when Meghan said that it would be boastful, she was intending to have a crack at Kate. But go onto the Twitter sphere and read all about it. I mean, it's quite extraordinary. Everything that's done is interpreted, and she was unwise and utterly, in my opinion, to have a couple of those articles in. For example, I mean, Harry saying we'll have two children max for the issue of saving the planet when she was talking to the primatologist, Dr. Jane Goodall. I mean, obviously this is going to start her controversy. I have to say I did think it was a bit preachy. I know it resonates with millennials, and I mean, the
Let's just test that, because technically, Natasha and Sam, you're both millennials. I mean, Natasha, we haven't really spoken since you got back to the country, and obviously Meghan became part of the royal scene and so on. I mean, what are your views on the whole thing? Or do you think, I don't know, I'd advise them to do something completely different?
Well, I was actually quite excited to get hold of a copy of the Vogue, this edition. I don't normally read Vogue, but I admire quite a few of the people that she's included within this special edit. So I haven't had a chance to look at it yet, but I will be getting hold of some. I think she's been quite clever in appealing to a younger audience. I think it certainly would appeal to, you know, someone who's not a typical Vogue reader around my age. Am I a particular fan of Meghan? Maybe I'm not as warm. I haven't warmed to her quite as much as I have other members of the royal family. But I can appreciate, I think, what she's trying to do with this particular episode.
Okay. And Sam, is it a case of, I really don't care?
I can't say I'm a regular Vogue fan, but or reader, but yeah, if she wants to put herself out there and
Or not, as the case might be. Exactly, yeah. Or not.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, the Channel 5, I know you'll be tuning in Princes at War at 9 o'clock on Saturday. You might see a familiar face.
Richard, the bottom line is the whole Channel 5 Royal Correspondence documentary strand would collapse if it wasn't for your good self on that particular
aspect.
Well,
I have to say, Princes at War question mark, because, you know, I don't believe there is a feud. I do believe there are big differences. I do believe a lot of the events that have happened have played into the narrative of the idea of a feud. I think that it will be interesting to see. I mean, I always, as a former editor of International, who obviously I was interested in Meghan's 15 women, radical women she chose. The whole point of this, of course, wasn't to omit Hillary Clinton or the Queen or Naomi Campbell.
Or Keira Knightley. Or Keira Knightley.
Ah, well, now there you have it. I have to say, Keira Knightley isn't probably radical enough for Meghan.
Whoa.
There is no doubt that it was quite a good... I mean, for example, you leave a space for the reader to put themselves and you can see yourself in the mirror and then perhaps consider what you might be able to do. I mean, it is somewhat modish, but it is rather intriguing. I like that bit of it, but I thought it was a terrible photograph of Michelle Obama. I mean, I'd be interested to hear any views on it, because it was a good interview, but the photo was one of the worst I've seen. It didn't seem well developed.
Richard, you know, Condé Nast, their budget cuts, etc., they can't apply the photographers. It was probably just some sort of junior reporter who actually had to give a sort of box brand camera.
It was with us, believe me. I mean, Vogue said for £2 and it will sell internationally on this. Edward Eddingfield will have been absolutely delighted to get Meghan, who spent 7 months on this. So, you know,
well, they are a lot slower, the Americans, than most of the rest of us. So I've heard, you know, in terms of actually where. I mean, Phil Linus could have things to say about that. I'm sure Tash would actually say sometimes.
Well, I mean, unfortunately, he's not here.
No.
Oh, you wouldn't dare say that.
Oh, I don't know. Change Your Life, Change the World, the line which is actually for the University of Lincoln in the current edition of Empire magazine. It's always nice. Obviously, it's wonderful when you actually see that strand there for a top 20 university, according to the Guardian University Guide. World-class research, excellent graduate prospects. That's just our corporate strand going, Richard. But it segues neatly in terms of film matters to a magazine which is certainly highly rated, Blinded by the Light, and effectively have actually given it four stars with the wonderful system here of a superb example of Luton in the 80s. But, as I said, I enjoyed it. I thought it was thoroughly entertaining. I don't think it was feel-good all the way. I think it was quite emotional, and I actually shed a couple of tears as well in certain sort of aspects of the whole thing, particularly the sort of father-son relationships. But it's over to you, Richard Fitzwilliams, Blinded by the Light.
Which I have to say, I mean, we've heard a lot, and I do enjoy coming-of-age movies, and I think they can be very moving. What actually, I have to say, surprised me, I do like Gurinder Chadha, though. I bet they'd like Beckham, yes, sure.
No Gurinder, no Keira Knightley. Sorry, I'll be quiet.
Well, no, and we didn't need her in this, quite honestly. I have to say that I was more moved than I thought I'd be. Because of this film, there are formulaic aspects to it that normally I think, oh my goodness me, I know what's going to happen. But even knowing or suspecting what is going to happen doesn't also the fact that, firstly, I mean, we really, really, really in Reveik, we've got an absolute top-class actor, Vivek Khaira as Javed. He's a British Pakistani who is in Luton, not an enviable place, in 1987, the time of Thatcher, and this is the story of how he finds himself through a couple of cassettes of Bruce Springsteen, which brings out his individualism, which is crushed by a very good performance by Kulindagir as his father, by a very, very traditional Pakistani upbringing, and his teacher, Mrs.
Stay away from the girls. Stay away from the girls. I won't say anything else because it could be borderline offensive, but still.
Yes, I was wondering if you'd complete the quote, and I could, but I don't
think... No, don't, Richard, please.
No, but in fact we've got a charming performance by his teacher who recognises in his poetry that there really is... So he really has a voice there. The only problem is, how can he express it? There is racial intolerance on the streets with the National Front, and he's personally spat at. There's also the fact that his proud father, intolerant though he is on the dole. The facts are that his inner voice must find expression. He is a poet who has undoubted charm, and Miss Clay, his teacher, Hayley Atwell, a lovely performance, recognises this. Can he escape, firstly, the town that he's dying to get out of, secondly, a family environment which crushes him, and thirdly, with the economic problems and with the dreadful racial situation, with marches through the town by the National Front, these Springsteen songs are the beginning of his salvation. It's a charming film, and I have to say that it is actually very moving. And for a movie, as I say, which a lot of this was of what we see is quite predictable, the clips on television, the time of Thatcher and so forth, the racial incidents, the scenes of the Pakistani household where you have a father so dominant, a very good performance, I have to say, by Kalinda Gear, and you have the crushing of individualism. Here you've got someone who's got a voice, and it's Springsteen, who, it's also a love letter to Bruce Springsteen, and Born in the USA and Darkness on the Edge of Town are the two tapes that begin his personal journey, and I thought it was, it's certainly, I would say, Gurinder Chadha's probably her best film, actually, and certainly because of this Vivek Khara, we'll be seeing him again. We really will. I liked it. And Luton, good Lord, I mean, you're born there, you're...
Look, don't knock Luton. It was featured in an episode of Space 1999 because Fred Freiberger, the American producer at the time, when he was off to see Gerry Anderson, was driving down the road and saw Luton. That sounds like an alien planet. I will call my show The Rules of Luton. And, you know, it's immortalised on that basis. And let's not even start about Eric Morecambe and his fondness for the Hatters and the team. All right, I've never forgiven them for relegating my own Manchester City back in the day. But other than that, all's well with the whole world. I'll stand by Luton to a certain extent. I've even delivered an academic paper or two at the university there. Obviously, other universities are available, like Lincoln. Sam, you've heard Richard's view there of Blinded by the Light. Will you be checking out this homage to Springsteen and life in the 1980s before you were born?
Sure, yeah, but I'll give it a watch. Is it out now?
It is out now.
Yes, it is, indeed.
What about yourself, Natasha?
I mean, it's a no-brainer, isn't it? I love the boss. I mean, the director, she's amazing. I love Bend It Like Beckham and Bride and Prejudice and some of her other works. And it just seems like a really great movie. If I may ask, Richard, what do you think of this sort of new, it's almost like a new kind of genre we're seeing of movies that are kind of about someone's music or about someone's, because some of them have done really well, like Bohemian Rhapsody. And then others like Rocket Man and maybe Yesterday haven't met as kind of as good critical response, or maybe haven't as done well numbers wise. Why do you think that is, and how do you think Blinded by the Light rates in that?
I'm fascinated by this, actually. It's a very good question, because also I think we've got a documentary coming up about Mick Hucknall. We've got a documentary by Nick Bloomfield about Leonard Cohen and his muse. This idea of, I mean, Rocket Man did terribly well. I haven't looked at the recent box office figures, but I think you would be surprised. I'm pretty sure it's a vast hit, and with Elton John behind it, I mean, I think you would expect that. With Bohemian Rhapsody, this was the surprise hit, especially since there have been so many problems about, in the making of it, and I think we've got a new trend. It's interesting, actually. Thanks for bringing the point up, because what we're seeing at the moment are several types of films. There are more musicals generally anyway, and you know, you could quote from La La Land to Mamma Mia and so on, and also you've got the live action Disney. That's another trend, and both of them that I like personally. Of course, sci-fi is box office dominates the box office, but there's no doubt also that the Strand, where you've got rather quirky and unusual stories, yesterday was one example, this is another. Hopefully we'll see a few more films, because, I mean, given the appeal of music, given the fact that everybody's got their favourite singers, favourite tracks, and so on, I mean, it's clearly something that they can explore with a lot more movies. Certainly, I notice, though, that we not so many thrillers and dramas just at the moment, and also when it comes to historical films, they seem to be on Netflix and not in the mainstream cinema.
Hobbs and Shaw, that's quite a thrilling movie.
I actually just mentioned Swords and Sandals, epics. I'm not it would quite fit that. Yeah. But no, I agree. I think it is very interesting. I will have a look at the way the box office is moving. I think it's moving very favourably. I think you'll find Rocket Man's a vast success. Bohemian Rhapsody, sure, that was fantastic. Yesterday had this infuriating Richard Curtis feel to it.
It was too schmaltzy, we've said that before. And plus, in the case of Natasha Armstrong, somebody who actually once shocked her fellow students by actually saying, I don't really like the Beatles.
What happens to heretics these days?
Burnt at the stake, I think.
I won't go, but there are certain things attached to it.
In fact, they probably were so shocked that they did nothing.
It's true. The whole seminar just literally came to a complete halt. we're just completely sort of stunned by the whole thing. Origins of Modern Britain, we had to change it. We didn't change the title of the module. It was just had to go completely. Anyway, that's a bye-bye for the joys of journalism. Now, I'm personally looking forward, Richard, to a musical version of Apocalypse Now, because surely it's just waiting to be written, isn't it? Napalm in the Morning.
You talk about the Doors, and you talk about that opening sequence, the helicopters synonymous with the war, dropping that napalm in the jungle onto the music of the Doors. Their blades blend into those of the fan in the hotel room of Captain Benjamin Willard, played by Martin Sheen. He wants a mission. Well, he gets a mission. This is set in Vietnam, and no movie has portrayed the crazed lunacy of war better. Indeed, it's entered cinema legend, and I saw it in the IMAX screen. I really, 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 if you have any chance of doing so, it's probably not easy. I would recommend it, because it's extraordinary. Willard is sent up river to terminate with extreme prejudice a once brilliant officer, Colonel Walter Kurtz, played by Marlon Brando, who's gone rogue and become leader of an army of terrorists in Cambodia, and his followers see him as a form of deity. And the scenes in this are amazing. I mean, there's the infamous and mesmerizingly macabre attack on the defenseless Viet Cong village by helicopters to the tune of Wagner's Ride of the Valkyries, led by a megalomaniac, Kilgore, a lieutenant colonel played by Robert Duvall, so his men can get some surfing. There's surreal scenes of fighting around the Do Lung Bridge, which is like a fireworks display. There's a shocking massacre of a sampan as Captain Willard is taken upriver in a patrol boat. And, I mean, it's extraordinary. At the end, I do still struggle with aspects of, but there's no doubt Brando gives a performance you won't forget, because nothing about this movie can be forgotten. It's amazing imagery, the photography by Vittorio Storaro, and even Dennis Hopper's the maniacal photographer who worships Kurtz. I mean, this is a great movie. There's no question. The whole concept of it, Francis Ford Coppola, the director, a wayward genius, it's one of the most amazing films ever made. Making it was apparently a nightmare, but there's no doubt it's quite extraordinary watching a patrol boat go upriver, this rather surreal feel, B-52s crashing into trees, the mists, Richard,
it sounds like the average event when there's a postgraduate open day at the University of Lincoln. I mean, particularly, I mean, substitute the Mekong River with the Brayford Pool, you pretty much got the whole sort of system, basically. I mean, I'm very impressed.
Yes. And usually that's influenced, isn't it, by Conrad's novella Heart of Darkness.
Yes, it is. Or if he'd been around today, Joseph Conrad probably would have written Heart of Lincoln, but never mind.
I have to say, seriously, it is amazing to see this film again, and if you have the opportunity, please see it on the large screen, and then it will take you over. It is absolutely mesmerizing.
Let's start off with Natasha this time. Have you ever seen Apocalypse Now? Is it something you might consider going to check out, or is it a case of, don't know?
40 years ago, it's made.
Yeah, so before she was born, just. Yeah, so.
Wow, Alex, I'm not that old. I've never actually seen Apocalypse Now, which is quite surprising because I'm quite into my sort of older war movie epics. My father always put Zulu on at Christmas.
Classic.
Oh, yes, no, Zulu is an amazing, very well made film, and of course that made Michael Caine. Mm.
So no, I will probably get around to watching it at some stage. Are they still showing it? Did you mention that they're playing it in an IMAX cinema?
I saw a preview in an IMAX, but I don't know how many screenings there are. There was one, for example, 2 days ago at the Soho cinema in Shaftesbury Avenue. There is a chance of seeing this. IMAX is the ideal, but anything on a large screen, because the small screen, however...
So, once again, Richard, you're saying probably not on the mobile phone or tablet. It's not best viewed there.
Dreadful. I mean, it is an experience. It's the final cut. It is, in fact, 202 minutes, and this is... Coppola's say there was Apocalypse Now, then there was Apocalypse Now Redux, and now this is his final. Certain scenes where they come up in the patrol boat, come across a French family who are diehards. Good performance there by Christian Marquant, who used to be a well-known French actor. There's also a scene of bunny girls there lifted into the jungle to entertain the troops, which adds to the craziness of it all. You could just about believe anything you see. Anything could happen. Indeed, it could with this type of war in this sort of environment and with this mission, especially as the patrol boat goes upriver and is attacked from the sides by unseen assailants. It is extraordinary. It's an experience that, you know, reviewing it is one thing. It's conventional, what I've been saying, but it is an experience.
Do you think that it still has its relevance in today's society in terms of kind of almost 40 years late? Well, it is 40 years later since it was made. Do you think that people go back to it because it made an impact when they first watch it, or they kind of still feel connected to it now?
I think they still feel connected firstly to the cinematic aspects, and certainly when it comes to the horrors of war, I fear there have been several examples of wars that should not have been fought in most cases since the time it was made. I do think it's relevant. I think it's fascinating. It's basically it gives you an insight into the human heart of darkness. They're very disturbing aspects of the human psyche, and also if you look at the way you respond to it yourself, there are slightly disturbing aspects perhaps of that. That is precisely what this film intends to reveal.
Richard, I'm watching the trailer now on my device here, my tablet device. I think you don't need a big screen at all, are you? There, it's perfectly there.
Picture,
all sorted through for that point. It's marvellous. Presented in stunning new high-definition transfers. Anyway. I take your point, though. If you want to actually have a full cinematic experience, then basically maybe it's important that you actually... Yes, that's quite enough now. You actually did see it in the large screen. Richard, we have covered a whole range of ground, as we knew we would, and we haven't even talked about Night of the Iguana.
Perhaps that still will be on. It's one of Tennessee Williams' most popular plays, reasons for it, and that perhaps could wait till next week, as it's only just opened.
Mm-hmm. That makes sense to me. But Natasha?
I would recommend it, by the way, the Noel Coward Theatre.
Okay, we'll put it down on the list of things
to
do.
And when it comes to heat, extraordinary seeing Apocalypse Now, which of course it's so hot it's almost tangible, and the Night of the Iguana, which is set in Mexico, everyone's dripping with sweated.
Well, this is what happens when you actually have the Sussexes actually using private jets and increasing global warming as opposed to actually, you know, pedalos and such like. You know, this is neither. Natasha, will you ask those last two questions to Richard Fitzwilliams now, please?
Okay, Richard, have you had a reasonably interesting telephonic link with us this morning?
I have indeed.
Wonderful. And will you be gracing us again next week?
Most kind of the use of phraseology, and indeed I will.
Sam, will you be seeing Apocalypse Now?
Yeah, well, I watch it. I'm a fan of war movies. Perhaps I could use your tablet.
It's a way forward, certainly. I mean, the challenge is I had to actually just get it all locked into the system. Meanwhile, because you can never have enough of Bruce... So if you know anybody or you are receiving your A-level results today or in any way, shape or form, first of all, say don't panic. Congratulations, well done. And remember, there's a lot of life to be lived, isn't there, Ian Lennox?
Oh, yes. 60 years, 70 years.
60, 70
years. Not the end of the road.
Never.
All the beginning.
Exactly. Not the end or the beginning, not even the beginning of the end. Natasha Armstrong's back with us, Ian. She's been in Japan, she's been in Houston, she's been in New York. She's now in Newark, Nottinghamshire. She'll be going down to London, but she's connected via Skype. Just for yourself in many ways, Ian. You know, it's there. It's important thing. Tash, it's 19 minutes to 9 o'clock. Just coming up to 19 minutes to 9 o'clock. And it's been quite some time, I think, since you spoke to Ian Lennox, of course. We won't talk football. We'll be talking rugby. And Ian will probably say, oh, well, that's Arthur McKenzie's line, really. I can only talk about the joy of Mike Ashley and Newcastle United. But you're close to getting a win on Sunday, you know, just a 1-0 defeat.
Yes, pretty much same old, though. You put us under pressure and we can't pass the ball properly, so...
Yeah, but you know...
Then I recorded the England game, so I watched that afterwards, and I thought they were going to blow it again, but they didn't. They came back and won deservedly, I think. Yeah. They had four locks on, didn't they? And they scrummed one time, it was like pushing a tractor.
Well, I mean, this is the... So, I mean, Tasha, yeah, I know you're a follower of the lozenge-shaped sport, lozenge ball-shaped sport, rugby, etc. Are England going to do it? Or is it a case of It's not going to happen. I mean, you were literally in Japan, hopefully laying the groundwork for Eddie Jones' Boys, not too far away from the stadiums that they're going to be playing in. Is that right?
Yeah, that's correct. So I actually lived in Yokohama, which is maybe about 30 minutes away from Tokyo. And the actual stadium that they're going to use for the final is in a place called Sakuragicho. Lovely, huge baseball stadium. And they have a huge countdown clock there. And that was very exciting. I also went up to Sapporo on the North Island and stood in their one of the stadiums that England's going to be playing in, though it's going to be very cold when they're playing up there. So hopefully no one's going to freeze and the ball's not going to be rock solid.
I love the way you talk about freeze and balls in the same sentence there. It's wonderful. You know, it's got so many connections. It just proves that a good journalist graduate from the University of Lincoln can go tabloid with the best of them. It's genius. Anyway, brass monkey weather, perhaps. Well, I mean, the message now is clear to Eddie Jones's Boys. Do it for Natasha. You know, she's been there. She's done the whole thing. Got to ask you, Tash, did you ever take part in any of the Japanese tea ceremonies when you were over there?
Yes, I did. I did one in Kyoto. It was very, very interesting. Probably you have to be quite delicate and quite dainty, and I'm not a very dainty person. I'm rather lanky, so my sort of overly long limbs tend to get in the way. But it was very fascinating. I did it with a group of people, which kind of makes it nicer because there's a sort of whole ritualistic aspect to it. Certain phrases. Don't ask me to recall the phrases. I can't remember.
Domo Marigato. You know, that's a good one. You know, Domo Marigato. That's good. Hi. You know, that's marvellous.
Yeah.
I mean, also quite dangerous. I'll counsel both Ian and Sam on this. If you have any risk of cramp, you know, if you sort of salt levels in your bloodstream a bit high, you crack could be very embarrassing if you suddenly you just posed in a sort of semi lotus position and then suddenly you know, very painful. So just it's very, very difficult. just advice, Ian, when you have
it sounds a bit like the hacker in slow motion.
Well, the way I would do a Japanese tea ceremony, that's probably right. You know, the way Tasha would probably do it is much more sophisticated and you know, par for the course, really, on that sort of system. Ian, Sam is with us for a wee while because he's talking about the awesome stuff he does as... Sam, your official title at the University of Lincoln is?
Postgraduate officer.
Postgraduate officer, exactly. So, would you like to quiz Sam on what, as a postgraduate officer, he can offer somebody like yourself... Or indeed, somebody who's graduated with a degree in all sorts of ways.
Well, I've never heard of a postgraduate officer, so the first thing I would ask is, what do you do?
What do you do, Sam?
What do I do? Yes, I recruit to the master's courses here at the university, offer a point of expertise, guidance, raising the profile of the university, and advertising what we can do at postgraduate level, both in taught and research. Masters.
Have you ever been tempted, Sam, ever, when somebody's applied to say, you don't want to do that?
No, never.
So, are you sure? You know, really? You know, don't know about that. Maybe when you
what,
sort of...
What would you do a master's in, Alex?
Well, I mean, my master's was film and television
back in the days. Yes.
Exactly. And sort of my own postgraduate work for the whole system there. In terms of currently, I mean, there's so many sort of opportunities. And obviously, just, you know, 2-3 degrees, you can go have as many degrees as you wish, basically.
Absolutely, yeah,
work on that premise. Remember, learning is a lifelong experience, Ian. It's the important thing.
Yes, I remember, actually, it sort of reminded me that when my son got his degree, he was 30 years old for what he wanted to do. And he thought he might be like to become an archaeologist. And I've been filming with somebody like that. And I said, "Oh no, don't do that."
Yeah, exactly. They've all
got brains. They've all got brains the size of houses, and they've got no, they don't get paid for it.
Yeah, well, that's why you go into education, really, for the fantastic... it's great. It's passion. It's passion. Tasha, have you ever thought of... I mean, I know we talked about whether you'd like to do a postgraduate thing or something from that point of view. Do you ever get a hankering for sort of saying, yes, at the end of the day, I wish to learn more things?
Yes, I think learning more things is, well, as you said, it's all part of life, isn't it? I think the minute you stop learning things, what's the point? But I definitely consider doing a postgrad. I think even if sort of from an academic perspective, you don't get much out of it. I think you can get lots of other things, certainly culturally, different experiences, opens you up to new individuals. What's the strangest postgrad course that they do, Sam, at Lincoln? Just out of interest.
Very good question.
Stranger course.
Depends what you define by strange.
I mean, I'm talking Stranger Things here. You know, Series 3 is going very well. Have we actually got any kind of nuclear physicists trying to actually engage in people doing psychokinetic experiments and so on? Who knows?
But maybe this
very evening, from Mountains to Molecules, our very own science theme program, we'll actually be able to tell you with Josephine Westlake and so on. See what I did there? It segued into a program just out of an apparently sort of random thing there.
Naturally.
And I bet Natasha hasn't even looked at Netflix and Stranger Things, so it might have been a completely sort of random thing there. What day?
I should tell my kids, don't do something that bore you, and don't care about the money, just find something that interests you.
Do something you love.
The worst thing to be is bored. I was very pleased to find that there's another Evelyn Woff used to suffer from boredom.
Evelyn Woff?
Didn't get bored of doing what he does. What the hell is the chance for the rest of us?
I would have always said Evelyn Waugh, but Evelyn Woff is wonderful.
Oh, sorry, it is Evelyn Waugh, yeah.
But you're from Newcastle, so obviously Evelyn Waugh would be Waugh Evelyn, surely. Exactly. Got to reframe the whole thing. Sam, have we managed to find an unusual course, or is it a case of...
So many to pick from.
Go on, throw a couple out. Throw a random thing.
Who knows? Nanomaterials science, that's
like
a strange one for me.
Nanomaterials science, and that ultimately...
Nanites,
teeny tiny molecular sort of aspects beginning to work through cells and so on. That can be pretty strange in a good way. Natasha, the next task that you need to do as our ace co-host, even though you're operating remotely from Newark, not New Jersey, Ian, but Newark, Nottinghamshire.
Right.
Yeah. Is to decide which tune Ian gets to listen to. It's something we used to have as a regular feature when Camo from Nashville used to obviously play an opening thing on the Wednesday evening, and then Camo moved on to various other bits and pieces. Well, not one, but two, actually, because we've got Tessa's Choice, of course, which is Jess and the Bandits. Or alternatively, we could throw in the mix the wonderful Morrissey Marshall little number. Again, it could be open for Sam as well. It's where they get a reprise. But Tasha, it's up to you to determine which one we provide for the listener, for Ian, and for Sam in terms of this little option. And you've heard them both, so it's your decision.
I think we should go with the Morrissey one.
Yeah, I thought your loyalty to Testnut would actually be tested on that one, basically. I just thought, you know, we love Jess, we thought she was great, but I had a feeling you might just go for Morrissey Marshall. Are you ready for this, Ian?
Yes, I'm braced.
She's Got Love. With a slight introduction, which kind of deals with the car shutting, and then it suddenly kicks in, and then as if by magic, oh, the power, the power.
Bye.
Splendid. What did you make of that, Sam?
Brilliant. Absolutely loved it.
Echoes of Oasis. We talked about this with Marshall last night, of course. Does it still float your boat, Natasha?
Yeah, I think that hit the spot just right this morning.
And what about Ian, Morrissey Marshall? First time you've heard it, what did you make of it?
Well, I don't like listening to music on the phone.
I know, yeah, it's true, yeah. This is a really, but?
There's such a thing as a fog of sound, it would be that. Yes, it is. I like a little kind of progression of the thing.
Yeah, fog of sound. That's really good. That's almost as bad as the pigeon line we actually had last night, which was a totally exhausted pigeon, I believe. Still, never mind. It was with an author, writer, Ian, from Canada, who called her dog Thor, the God of Thunder, although she's never ever seen a Marvel movie, and obviously was coming from a Norse mythology person because her father had forbidden her, or her partner had forbidden her from actually using any other mythologies, so she went Norse. It's strange, I know, but listen again, it's Jenna Green. Right, Natasha hasn't sort of said, no, you've got that completely incorrect, Alex. Sort it out, you know, it's very true. Ian, what are you doing the rest of the day?
I'm doing a bit of writing.
Good.
Retreat to my hammock if it's still sunny.
Yeah, I don't think it's hammock weather, if I'm being absolutely brutally honest. I mean, Natasha in Newark, is it hammock weather?
It's more hammock weather than it was yesterday. It was terribly miserable yesterday. Yeah. I'm not sure, kind of being a northern lass, I sort of risk a hammock at all, kind of in the UK. But so,
I'm very brave. Hammock at duvet if necessary.
A duvet? Duvet and a hammock, perhaps. An external duvet.
If we're gone, just go to sleep in my hammock.
Yeah, that's very true. Anyway, I just was smiling at Natasha's description of herself as a northern lass. I mean, obviously, Ian, to us in the real northeast, you know, being in the East Midlands, that's not north. I mean, that's you know, a northern lass. Honestly, Tash, really.
My father is Cumbrian. It counts.
Yeah, I go with that to a certain extent, but still. Okay, Natasha, several questions, because first of all, we've got to wrap up with Sam, because Sam has to leave us now, so it's just going to be yourself and myself, Tasha, for the next hour, because no sign of Fergus. We've got Stephanie Ramoshevsky, of course, we've got Alice Tea Cake. I know, Alice Tea Cake. And many others, including Dr. Ava, will be joining us. But would you like to ask Sam first about his experience on the last 3,600 seconds that's been the Midweek Drive Morning Edition on Siren Radio today?
Yes, Sam, have you had an enjoyable time on Siren this morning?
Very enjoyable indeed, as always.
Excellent. And first of all, good luck for Saturday. I'm sure it'll go amazing.
Thank you very much.
Will you be joining us again to tell us how it goes, maybe?
Yes, we will, yeah. I'll be on next week, hopefully, if Alex will have me.
Next week, yeah, I think so. Yeah, I think we can.
It's going to be a weekly occurrence
now, isn't it? Whoa! it's one delightful thing after another, really. And keeping the wonderful battle ongoing, because I know Ian's just kind of keenly waiting there to see, come on, I've got to get on with some writing. I need to actually get on with this now. Would you like to put those last two questions to Ian? From Newcastle, as opposed to Cumbria, but of course you've got Northumbria and Cumbria there, so you know, genuine, you know, northern lad.
Okay, Ian, have you had a reasonably interesting telephonic link with us this morning?
Yes, I have, thank you.
Wonderful, and I hope you enjoy your hammock. Will you be coming to join us again same time next week?
Provided I don't fall off too badly, yes.
Just a little, the literal phrase there. I hope you enjoy your hammock. I think, again, I'm going to sort of add that to the whole. So it's awesome. As we mentioned, coming up after the news, Alice Tea Cake, a whole range of other goodies as well. Plus, of course, we get the chance, if you missed it earlier, to hear Natasha give the weather forecast for Lincoln, England, from Newark, Nottinghamshire. Amazing. so it goes. Moving on to the weather for Lincoln, England, from Newark, Nottinghamshire, courtesy of Natasha.
Okay, so Lincoln is going to see some highs of 20 degrees and some lows of 11 degrees. It's a day of sunny intervals and a fresh breeze.
Excellent. Now, Natasha, we talked about this in the first part of the programme. Nearly half of British folk have never visited any of the British Isles outside of mainland England. And to discuss this, we're delighted now to welcome back to the programme an awesome individual with the classic line from tkatetravels.com, adventure travel for kick-ass chicks. It's the amazing, wonderful Alice Teacake. How are you, Alice?
Good morning. I'm great, thank you.
Excellent. Now, adventure travels. I mean, Natasha, as we heard, come back from Japan. She's doing all sorts of things, etc. And yet, in the English Channel, in the around our very own island of Britain, it would seem that people aren't aware of some of the good things that are actually there that can be found, that can be accessed, and indeed even finding out where the Isle of Wight is on a map.
Yes, I mean, that is quite true. Yeah, according to Premier Inn, their latest research shows that 58% of Brits could not point to the Isle of Wight on the map. That's a little bit worrying, isn't it?
I'm not sure whether it's an educational thing or whether it's just a case of people up there, but, I mean, we've got 187 hidden gems sitting right on our doorsteps, which we're ignoring. You can go to the world's smallest chapel in Guernsey. Again, Natasha, regular midweek drivette. We have, of course, Jessica, who moved from New Zealand to the Isle of Man to work through a range of elephants and beasts. I mean, Jessica, this particular aspect, I mean, I think you're quite an Isle of Man fan, are you not, Tash?
Yeah, I love the Isle of Man. I love the Isle of Wight. Mm-hmm. I think these small little islands, they've got so much to offer, and it's shocking that more people don't know about them.
So, Alice, you know, from the point of view, and clearly we need your role as a travel blogger and influencer here to kind of share that message using the traditional medium of radio and audio, etc. How can people actually effectively, you know, find out about these things? And why is it that people don't know how many British Isles there actually are?
Yeah, I mean, I think that really is a great question. I think just, you know, in terms of travel trends over the years, we've always kind of thought, right, now I want a holiday, I'm just going to get on an airplane and go long haul over to maybe Spain or France. You know, we just kind of had that within us to go to those kind of countries. But I think times are changing. You know, we've kind of had the staycation where we stay at home, but now Brits are kind of thinking more about a midi break. They're thinking, right, you know, what is actually on my doorstep that, you know, I can still travel to, but which actually has the adventure, the food, the kind of relaxation that I'm looking for, but is in the British Isles. And, you know, there really are some lovely, lovely islands that you've mentioned. Isle of Man is definitely one. But, you know, we've got all up in Scotland, we've got the Channel Islands down below. There is a lovely choice to be had and many, many things to be discovered.
You've obviously got Peel Castle on the Isle of Man, Mercia Island. I must admit, I was not familiar. You can also taste the oysters on Mercia Island. Obviously, you can have homemade ice cream from the Jersey cows and so on. And, of course, in Herm, H-E-R-M, it's a car-free island.
I mean, I just love that. I mean, it's just, it's only half a mile wide. And, you know, if you really do want to get away from it completely, yeah, why not ditch the car and just do a little bit of gentle trekking?
Is this tempting you, Natasha? Is it something where you're sort of thinking, forget the trip back to New York to actually look after house sitting and various other bits and pieces, back to Houston, Texas, etc. I'm going to check out Mercia Island and taste those oysters.
I mean, I'm not personally a fan for oysters, but it sounds like an adventure. I think there's a rich history, I think, with a lot of the islands. I love Linda's Farm. That's another one I think people should check out. Yeah, there's just so much to discover. I mean, Guernsey, I think, is another one that a lot of people maybe haven't heard of, particularly with the war. I think there's a rich history. I always up for little island adventures. I think they're undiscovered gems.
Alice, do you have any particular favourites? I mean, Tash mentioned Lindisfarne there, which is Holy Island, I suppose. So, and beware of the tides. That's all I'd say. Beware of the tides if you're going to there. But any thoughts where we could say, yeah, actually, forget the trip to out of Madagascar this time around, etc. We're going to check out Jersey.
Yeah, I mean, Jersey definitely is a great start. I do have my favourites in the last couple of years, because I have to say, I was one of those people that was travelling on the other side of the world for about 8 years. You know, I really was like, if I want a venture, I'm going to have to go all the way to the other side of the world. But in the last 2 years, I really started to explore what's local to me. I particularly love the Aran Islands in Ireland. They are absolutely beautiful. And also, it's really becoming quite popular lately, the Isle of Skye in Scotland. It's beautiful. And it's got lots of medieval castles and fishing villages, rugged landscapes. But yeah, I mean, why not just go for the classic? How about the Isle of Wight? You know, it, it really is a lovely island, and Premier Inn are popping up some hotels there. It's the perfect place to go.
The Isle of Wight, Natasha. Is that the case here? The Isle of Wight and Natasha, is that almost a match made in heaven?
Do you know what? I obviously, besides Lincoln, I think Isle of Wight is just my favourite place in the whole of the UK. There is so much you can do, and you can get round it all. If you have a car, you can travel to anywhere. It's not somewhere that needs a lot of thought. You can camp it. I mean, I've had friends that have run round it. It's just such an accessible place, and there's so many wonderful things to see, and you can be at one with nature. It's brilliant.
Well, clearly, Alice, Natasha is firmly convinced by the Isle of Wight, and that's just great from that point of view. Is it a case of, well, we're looking at traditional holiday destinations that we will be changing, but actually with climate change and various other bits of people looking for midi breaks, etc., we are actually forgetting the joys that we actually have, not quite on our own doorstep, but certainly in our own land.
Yeah, and I think that is a great point. We are becoming more eco-conscious. And, you know, also that hassle of kind of getting to the airport and flying all the way for quite a long time, you know, we can still pop on a plane, but it'd be a lot quicker. Yeah, I do agree with you. I think why not just see what's a little bit closer to home?
I'd certainly actually give a solid plug for tktravels.com, which, again, I think is an awesome website from that point of view. And the line of wanting to push to face your fears, push your boundaries and reach your full potential through solo travel, you're in the right place. You're like a superhero, Alice. It's just great stuff. But is there anybody else that you'd recommend? Any other website? Possibly Premier Inns, maybe? And you'd actually suggest, for more information about certainly our islands around the country, where would you suggest people should go?
Yeah, definitely pop along to premierinn.com. They've got a lot of information there, and you can definitely start planning the adventure that you want in the British Isles.
Well, that makes perfect sense. Alice, have you had a reasonably interesting telephonic link with us on the programme today?
Yes, thank Good. You so That's much. A... I appreciate it.
There was that pause there. You know, you can tell you're expecting Natasha to ask the question. You're thinking, where are we going on this? I don't know. Is he suddenly doing sort of customer satisfaction surveys? Do we get a smiley face, etc.? Lord above. Well, the next critical question is, can we look forward to connecting with you again in the not-too-distant future? Will you be kind enough to return and keep us appraised of adventure travel for Kick-Ass Chicks and more?
It would be my pleasure.
Hey, Alice Tea Cake. As I said before, I mean, Natasha, you've got to say, a surname called Tea Cake, it's just wonderful, isn't it? I mean, I'm presuming the pronunciation is right, Alice. It's not T-R-K-K, is it? Or
T-K-K-K or anything. Tea Cake, yeah.
Just wanted to clarify that. Excellent.
The website has made me smile so much, by the way. You have, like, my favourite logo of all time.
Yeah.
Bless you. Thank you so much.
I would go along with that and endorse that, Tasha, just for the logo alone. She's a superheroine. Been sent up and I've been shut down. You're the best thing that I've ever found. Handle me with care. Reputation's changeable. Situation's terrible. But baby, your body next to mine and dream on. I've been fucked up and I've been fooled. I've been loved and ridiculed in daycare centers and night schools. Handle me with care. Yeah.
support, terrorize, sent to meetings, hypnotized, overexposed, commercialized, and
Travelling Wilburys, Handle With Care, and Why Not, as we continue to progress from, I still think, actually, Atasha Tiarkake will be quite good, actually. I'll just work on that.
She sounds like an Indian chieftain. It's wonderful.
Yeah, exactly. That would definitely work. Poor quality sleep is apparently leaving a third of us depressed and anxious. Recent researchers have revealed 31% of British folk feel depressed if they feel tired. And 30% obviously say they feel anxious. Nearly half of us say they consider themselves sleep deprived. And a third say they have a broken night's sleep most nights. Does this echo with yourself, Natasha? Is it a case of, no, I sleep like an angel every night?
I don't think it quite echoes with me personally. I need a lot of sleep, which is quite funny. I generally need about a good eight and a half hours, otherwise I'm a little bit grumpy. But it affects a lot of people I know. Japan is probably the most sleep deprived country in the world. So it was quite interesting. People are just exhausted. I've seen people sleep standing up on the train out there. I've had people sleep on me on the train, complete strangers.
Hold it there, Tasha, because we're going to actually go to Stephanie Romashevsky, our resident sleep expert, who's going to be talking about this, and I'm sure she'll be fascinated by some of those Japanese tales as well, in a matter of moments from now. Time for Suggs. Waiting for that sleepy feeling. I mean, Natasha, just share with us one more time. We've had people sleep literally standing up on a Japanese train when you're over there. Is that?
Yeah, you can do it as well because you're packed in like sardines.
Whoa.
Yeah, hey. It's crazy. The limited amount of sleep my students get, my friends would get, people just falling asleep constantly. Normal to get about 5 hours sleep, which I think is crazy.
Listen, it's just as well Stephanie Romashevsky offers international consulting from that point of view, because certainly it sounds as though the whole Japanese nation needs the help of our sleep expert, Stephanie Romashevsky, together with Benson's Beds, etc. Stephanie, welcome back to the Midweek Drive Morning Edition. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. How are you doing?
Excellent. We just have a little added bonus, because I know you're joining us again to resume various other bits and pieces in the next week's time. But this particular thing, we've looked at the findings of this research. Poor quality sleep having a devastating impact on the mental health of people across the UK. You heard there from Natasha, who's connected with us via Newark, from Newark, via Skype and so on. But, you know, clearly there are issues in other countries where people are literally so stressed they're falling out in that sort of ways. We need a sleep diet, Stephanie.
Yes, I think we might do. So I think we all know that a poor night's sleep has not great effects on us. There's lots of advice out there. And I think what we were trying to do when we created this sleep diet for Benson for Beds is sort of try to hone it down to the things that might be really helpful. Everybody is different, so there isn't just one type of sleeper. So our profiles, for example, we've got the lie-in lover. So I think me and you, Alex, have talked about this before, about how lying in and overcompensating might not be very helpful. We've got the tech addict, the energy obsessed, the overthinker, someone who adapts their time, so they're cancelling all the fun things during the day because sleep's bad, and that actually makes it worse. So all these are different types of sleepers. So we wanted to try and find, you know, the most realistic and positive steps for those people without giving them a long list of things that don't work.
That makes sense. I mean, just in case people are confused, that it's the lie-in lover, as in L-I-E-N, lying down, not the lion lover, as in take fit and a lion sleeps tonight. Because easily confused, Stephanie.
Yes, absolutely.
I'd hate people to say, but I'm sure Stephanie said I should sleep with a lion. No, it's just like. Tasha, you've listened to some of those things. Any questions that you'd like to put to Stephanie about this research and so on?
Yes. I've seen a lot of this big trend recently. A lot of people are sort of supporting the whole get up at 5 a.m. and sort of go to bed earlier, and that's meant to leave you more refreshed and more productive. How much does your research stand by that? I mean, personally, 5 a.m. horrifies me.
Yeah, well, that horrifies me a little bit as well. I think it's more that if your sleep is more regulated, that's good. And that's what we've put in the sleep diet, that actually it doesn't matter what kind of schedule you want to be on, but you just need to regulate it. So no, we don't all need to get up at 5 a.m. That's not going to suit all our natural sleep-wake cycles. But actually, if you wanted to get up at, say, 7 a.m. every day, that would be really good, rather than, say, 6 a.m. on the weekdays and then maybe 9 a.m. on the weekend. That kind of mix, your body doesn't really like it. It doesn't really help regulate our mood, our hunger, loads of different things during the day, let alone the quality of our sleep. So whilst I definitely think regulating sleep is great and making sure that you're giving yourself that opportunity every day is fantastic, I don't think we have to dictate to everybody a specific regimen. I think that is down to the individual and how that will fit in with their lives, because we're all different. We're all on different work schedules.
No, that's really helpful. Also, maybe people can't get to sleep. I know some people sort of lay awake at night worrying. Is there any sort of advice you give from sort of people working through anxiety or sort of just can't switch off?
Absolutely. So that's one of the our profiles on the sleep diet. But the biggest thing I would say is, I know it sounds a bit sort of unrelated, but the more you look at the things like regulating your sleep on a daily basis, so waking up at the same time every day, giving yourself permission to go to bed later if you're not sleepy, making sure that's a fairly consistent process and you're not overcompensating by lapping on lying in, I'm now saying lying in, you'll find that you'll have a different capacity to cope with all of that worry and stress. So the more regulated your sleep is, the more you can still have all that worry and stress, and your sleep won't be as affected. So that's what I think people really need to understand, that whilst that might seem very unrelated, stop looking for the reactive ways to fix it, i.e., you know, I can do this breathing exercise and suddenly I'm going to fall asleep. Though that might be helpful, you need to start regulating your sleep. But on top of that, if you're looking at the profile, which we do call the overthinker, you need to start thinking about processing during the day. So we've got all these helpful apps and technology and all this stuff out there now, which is talking about relaxation. And this is fantastic. But I think we're still looking at it very reactively. I can go around, run around all day, doing all these things I need to do. And then as long as I have an hour before I go to bed where I just look at all this tech, like, I don't know, Headspace and all these different things, fantastic that you're thinking about it, but you're looking at it too reactively. First of all, you've got to process. So give yourself an opportunity before you go to sleep, a few hours before, where you actually schedule in a time to worry and think about things. Maybe that's just reflecting on your day. Maybe that's a to-do list for tomorrow. Maybe that's just doing all the things that you usually put off until right till the end of the night, like undoing the dishwasher, because the only time you remember about it is just before you go to sleep, doing the kids' lunches. But if you give yourself an opportunity to process and do all that stuff before, then you're not going to be as likely to go into a dark room when it's bedtime and suddenly zing and you're suddenly awake. So it's a bit of a mixture of regulation so that you aren't as susceptible to these little niggly thinking bits in our heads, and also trying to deal with that a bit earlier in the day.
No, that's wonderful advice. Thank you very much.
That's all right.
It just helps everyone. Personally, I'd love to see PESCO actually wheeled out as a sort of resource in all sorts of ways. I couldn't resist that. I mean, go to the Sleepyhead Clinic on Facebook, and it's just, I mean, if you don't say, it's just great. And we're going to talk about that, I'm sure, at future times and so on. Stuff. It's brilliant stuff there. Just looking back at this research from Benson's for Beds again, 15% feeling miserable at the weekend because they're exhausted. That's not good. I mean, again, that's one of the key things, I think, looking at this stuff, that actually it's important that we do look at that and don't worry about lack of sleep and go through some of the things you suggested.
So true. And it does also show that compensation at the weekends is clearly not working. So instead of compensating, why not thinking, why is it that during the week we're getting little sleep when we really need it for work? And why is it that the only thing that wakes us up in the morning is work, and yet at the weekend when we literally could have the time to ourselves, we want to lie in a dark room for half the day? You know, we've got to think about this differently. We need to look at this more long term, you know, over a month, how are you going to regulate your sleep? Not 5 days on, 2 days off. That's not working. But you're absolutely right, Alex. We worry too much about sleep. We need to stop making sleep responsible for our entire lives. There are so many variables that affect us, like, for example, eating healthily, having regular exercise, you know, playing with your pets, having social time. We're social creatures, but all of that stuff seems to go out the window as soon as we start worrying about sleep. So we put too much emphasis on it, and then we move away from all that other lovely stuff that we desperately need to have a good night's sleep. So we've got to look at this differently. You're absolutely right. But worrying about sleep is not going to help. So let it go. If you're sleeping badly, what's the difference between worrying about it versus not? Because that's not, if anything, not worrying about it might actually make it better.
And that, Stephanie, is why you are our ace sleep doctor extraordinaire, as we've said many a time. Natasha, do you think that would help some of the citizens of Japan when you were over there teaching last year and sort of thinking, yeah, they could do with some sleep as opposed to all the stress factors?
Yeah, I certainly think that would help. I think sometimes people, particularly when they're shift working, they get sort of caught up with that whole, oh, I have to work now. This is my doctored sleep time, so it has to be now that I sleep, otherwise I'm going to go to work and nothing's going to work. So actually to just sit down and go, I'm not going to worry about this, I'm just going to sleep when I can, you know, it is good advice. And I think people sort of miss that in all the sort of apps and tech and fad diets and all that sort of nonsense.
Absolutely, I totally agree.
And where, Stephanie, would you point people in the direction of this particular survey for Benson's for Beds, etc., to find out more details about the aspects relating to the things we've been talking about this morning?
So this has been launched on the Benson's for Beds website today. So go and do the quiz, see what kind of sleeper you are, or maybe you're doing really well and there's a little profile for those people as well. So, you know, it's good to remain positive and get some education on sleep.
Splendid. And I think it's time now for Natasha to deliver those last two questions, without which basically Stephanie would say, well, you know, what happened to the last two questions then, basically? I mean, I need them, you know, so go for it, Tasha.
Okay, Stephanie, have you had a reasonably interesting telephonic link with us this morning?
Yes, it's lovely to be back.
Wonderful. And can we see you sometime again on the show?
Yes, you're seeing me next week, unfortunately for you.
That's not unfortunate. That's a joy, a joy unparalleled that life comes through in all sorts of ways. GCSE results day and Stephanie's advice on sleep and more about PASCO. I'll say it again. PASCO will be returning to demonstrate, quite frankly, Natasha, that puppy training and sleep training are fairly similar.
Yay!
Evocative of the 1990s, Sleeper, Sail of the Century. Why not, indeed? You're listening to the Midweek Drive Morning Edition. In the last little quarter of the programme today for August the 15th, A-Level Results Day in England, of course. And we have Natasha Armstrong in Newark, Nottinghamshire, who's been doing sterling duties. This is actually, Natasha, you've managed, you're in your fourth hour now of consecutive Midweek Drives, as though you've never been away, frankly. And the world's a better place as a result of that. It's great.
It's been a wonderful, enjoyable marathon. Well, the best kind of marathon.
Well, there you go. Now, if memory serves, and I could could be completely wrong here, but I do feel you know, an Electric Light Orchestra follow at one stage. Was that a band that sort of, or was it a case, no, please, no, stop it now?
I do like ELO. Mm-hmm. I mean, my father loves them, so I kind of had all my music choices drilled into me from the age of about four.
I had a feeling of that. And of course, in the case of ELO, not just a fantastic band with Jeff Lynne, Bev Bevan and Mick Kaminsky, but also a way of saying greetings to Yorkshire people, ELO. Yeah, you get there in the end. So was there a particular Electric Light Orchestra track that, to take us around to this next feature, which again deals with some advice for people who might be travelling over to Japan and might be involved with the World Cup as well, and some of the sort of important things you need to be aware of? And thankfully, you've come back safely, Natasha. Otherwise, when you listen to this, you might think, oh, my Lord, all of those stresses and strains. But was there any particular Electric Light Orchestra track which you might think, yeah, I'd like to go with that? I mean, are we Wild West Hero? Are we Confusion? Are we Secret Messages? Are we Shine a Little Love? Are we Sweet Talking Woman? Are we Hold On Tight? What would you go?
I think we're going to go a little bit western, as I'm going to Texas next month. We go a little bit Wild West.
Yeah, you see, it's almost as though we'd actually rehearsed the show, which of course we had, because the rehearsals went so well when we actually put them into place. What was it, about 2 or 3 weeks ago?
Yes.
Saddle up.
We'll be right back. The message with respect to the Encephalitis Society, we're clearly running very solidly with, because she was so impressive last week when we spoke to her about the importance of ensuring that this was sorted through, etc., that she's back again this week. It's the fabulous Chief Executive Officer of the Encephalitis Society. It's Dr. Ava Easton. How are you, Ava?
I'm well, thank you.
Excellent. I'm always tempted to say, Ava, that you're actually following the Rugby World Cup, because we had a rugby player last week. Now we actually have ex-England rugby player John Bentley with us. Good morning, John.
Good morning.
John, if we can come to you first and talk a little bit about this campaign that, again, we covered last week, but with the upcoming Rugby World Cup in Japan, of course, coming around the corner very, very closely, and great to see that England and Eddie Jones got a win on Saturday, so result then. But share with us your own experience, which, again, is quite astounding with respect to, obviously, encephalitis and how it's important to make sure that we work through this and take our precautions.
Well, I was approached, actually, obviously, as a result of the World Cup taking place in Japan, just to raise some awareness, really, about travelling to Japan, the intentions of people who, you know, they're not just taking the rugby with them, they'll go, the players, they'll be pretty solid with their preparations and their routine and their itinerary, but people going to Japan, I think one of the exciting things about it being in Japan, it's the first time it's been taken away from one of the heartlands. You know, normally South Africa, Australia, New Zealand, the UK, France, perhaps. So it's the first time it's been taken to Asia. And people will, I'm sure, take the opportunity to go to Japan and not just watch the rugby, but do some travelling. And I think the campaign's really about that, the awareness that there is potential to pick up this horrendous disease, really.
Yeah, I mean, Ava, just again, share with us once again the sort of inflammation of the brain, the sort of aspects and impacts that encephalitis can actually have, and how it can literally, it's gender blind, it's colour blind, it's whatever sort of aspect we could be, any age, ethnicity or sex, effectively can actually be impacted by this.
Yeah, so encephalitis simply is inflammation of the brain. It's an often devastating neurological condition. And what we're encouraging is people who are travelling to the Rugby World Cup, which is in Japan, as John mentioned, is really just to seek specialist advice about travel health. And some of that will include vaccinations. In some cases of encephalitis, it can be vaccine preventable. In other cases, it is not. So it's really important that this campaign is very broad and is about travel health, so that people are seeking advice that's appropriate to their travel plans. As John said, some people, you know, will extend their stay and go off into the countryside, or indeed may visit other countries that are in and around Japan. And things like tick-borne encephalitis and Japanese encephalitis, for example, they are vaccine preventable, but they occur right across Southeast Asia and the Pacific Islands, and in some cases with tick-borne encephalitis right across Europe. So really it's a campaign to raise awareness about travel health, get people thinking about that, whether they're going to the Rugby World Cup, whether they're going on holiday generally, and hopefully, you know, we can prevent some of these cases of encephalitis, some of which, unfortunately, there is nothing that we can do to stop, but in some cases we can. So it's really just to get people thinking.
We have two fabulous folk at the studio, both PR specialists in their own way. Of course, Kerry, ace journalist as well from that point of view. Kerry Hopkins, any thoughts from yourself? Because I think when you saw this little story, you're quite interested in terms of the encephalitis problem.
Yes, I mean, as the survey says, 78% of people do not know what it is, and I am one of those 78. And actually, I'm quite surprised it's that high. I guess it must be maybe people in Asia that know what it is. So what I'm interested in is, how do you pick this disease up, Dr. Ava?
So that's a great question. So encephalitis occurs in one of two ways, generally. People can get encephalitis from infections, and in some cases, those are ordinary everyday infections, such as the measles, flu, the cold sore virus, for example, and it breaches the blood-brain barrier and mounts a direct infectious attack on the brain. The other way that people can contract an encephalitis is through their own immune system going awry and attacking the brain in error. So it can be from some infections about which there is little that we can do, such as the flu or the cold sore virus. But I also mentioned measles there, which again is another vaccine-preventable type of the condition. So some ways of contracting it we can do nothing about, and then there are other ways which we can take preventative action.
So you don't have to even touch somebody, you can pick it up in Japan?
Well, it's
I mean, encephalitis occurs right across the world, and some forms of encephalitis occur in Japan, as they do in other countries, including the United Kingdom. It's, as I say, ordinary everyday infections can cause this.
Ava, as I've said many times before, we should all wear hazmat suits, you know, and that's the key thing, but stop, never mind, we'll be brave.
I think, Alex, you know, what we don't want to do is scare people at all. Yeah. This is a broad travel health campaign, and we don't want people going to Japan for the Rugby World Cup thinking that they're at high risk.
I'm going to die, I know.
So you can get vaccinated beforehand, can you?
You know, for people who are just flying in simply for the games, for example, who are just going to games in the cities, there's really very little for people to worry about. This is really about people who might be extending their stay into the countryside, going travelling, you know, where mosquitoes and ticks exist, for example, or if they're going to other countries that are close to Japan, where some of these types of encephalitis are, in fact, more prevalent. But this, the important message of all of this is, if you're travelling, please go and seek specialist travel health advice, and then people can get advice that's appropriate to their journey and their plans.
Yeah, and if they do get the disease, what's the chance of survival back to a normal, healthy life?
It's another good question, and it will depend on what the cause of their particular type of encephalitis was. So there are some causes where people could make a good to moderate recovery. There are other causes, such as measles encephalitis or Japanese encephalitis, where outcomes can be quite devastating with high death rates. But the, you know, tick-borne encephalitis, for example, is another one that, although there can be death attached to tick-borne encephalitis, actually outcomes can be less severe in many cases.
And very briefly, Emma, any questions from yourself?
Well, I think...
Stunned.
I am, yeah.
I'm going to leave it with basically John Bentley. I would turn to you briefly, John. What chance do you think Eddie Jones's boys actually have? Let's be positive. Are we going to do it? Are we going to bring it home?
Let's be positive, Alex. We've been positive for a long time, haven't we?
I see where you're going, yeah.
If it's anything to do with the last World Cup, we didn't make the knockout stages, so there's no chance of our boys contracting the condition, is there? But, do you know, I'm actually...
Harsh, but fair.
You know, I think, he announced his squad this week. I like Eddie Jones, I really do. He's a little bit of a maverick. He likes to play the press a little bit. He loves you guys. But I think ultimately, I think we'll perform. I really do think we'll perform. New Zealand will always be the favourites. And of course, Ireland and Wales have been very strong, and Scotland have shown good form, and there's South Africa and Australia. But everybody wants to beat England as well for some mysterious reason, John, don't they, Alex?
John, you said the magic words routine. Ava, will you be supporting the lads, or is it a case of no, I'm just here and as part of the Encephalitis Society as an awareness raising exercise?
I'm always supporting our lads, whether it's rugby or football or any other sport. You know, come on, England.
Marvellous. And finally, Ava, best place to go to find out further details about what we've been talking about today online for the Encephalitis Society would be
go to the web address, encephalitis.info/travel.
Dr. Ava Easton, Chief Executive Officer of the Encephalitis Society, and John Bentley, ace England rugby player, I'll say, John. You know, that's the way forward. Many thanks indeed. Take care now.
Thank you. Bye.
Well, there we are, and listening to that, obviously, thinking, right, I who'd have thought it when I was over in Japan? I could have died in all sorts of ways. Was a little bit worrying, I think, in times, Natasha, in terms of what we were seeing there, those tick-borne encephalitis scenarios, etc. I presume you had all your vaccinations and checks and all the rest of bits and pieces, or was it a case of, my God, people were sort of falling asleep and be on the train? Anything could have happened.
Actually, encephalitis is not something I've actually encountered. It's not something I actually knew about before I went out there. They do extensive amount of health checks before you go to make sure you are a healthy individual. For example, I had to get a chest x-ray to prove that my lungs were okay. They're very, very sort of nervous about anything to do with flu, so you had to prove that you're not a risk in terms of flu. Even when you're in the country, when you get if you get flu, it's seen as a big thing. You sort of have to be sort of put in quarantine, and you're sort of they don't want you anywhere near the workplace for a good solid week, if not more. So it's interesting. As I say, I didn't know anything much about encephalitis. I would warn travelers who are going out in the summer, mosquitoes are an issue. not to put you off. You can easily abate this. They've got lots of different mosquito repellents. Tiger Balm works very well. Or you can get a local, any of the local pharmacies, you can pick up mosquito repellents. I'm particularly prone to bites, so it can be quite uncomfortable. Don't learn the hard way like I did and end up looking like a walking pincushion. Just research before you go. I think that's the best way. From health side of things, also from a culture side of things, the Japanese culture is quite maybe different to the Western culture in subtle ways. So I'd always say do your research before you go out there, but obviously they understand that you're a tourist, so they're not expecting you to sort of behave like a local, so don't worry too much. But just be sensible and do your research, I would say.
And if you're following the Rugby World Cup, heaven only knows what's going to happen. I mean, listening to John Bentley there, he didn't seem to actually hold out much hope for the lads, did he, really? I mean, reading between the lines, I mean, he expects them to actually be home by the time we've actually still gone through the initial qualifiers.
I think we're in a really interesting position this year. I think there's lots of possibilities for who could win this. I mean, Ireland have been playing some sterling rugby leading up into this World Cup. They actually beat New Zealand a couple of times now, which is kind of exciting. Australia generally traditionally have been quite strong, but they've seen a little bit of a slip kind of leading up to it. So it'll be interesting with Pool D, with Wales, Australia, who's going to come out on that one. We've got a nice pool in terms of Pool C. Our main competition will probably come from France, maybe a shock from Argentina. So I think it's going to be a much more open World Cup this year. I don't think it's just a case of, oh, New Zealand's got it, you know? So I'm really excited to see where this is going to go.
Excited, exciting, tense, past, whatever. It's been fantastic. We certainly thank Richard Fitzwilliams, Ian Lennox, Alice Teacake, Stephanie Romashevsky, Dr. Ava Easton, John Bentley, and of course we heard little cameo appearances there from Kerry Hopkins, and indeed Emma, who didn't quite get her question out, but then he's very busy, very hectic, etc. Still probably recovering from last night's show, which was epic in all sorts of ways, and is of course available for download now from southsidebroadcasting.podbean.com, as this one will be in a matter of, I'd probably say about 40 minutes or so from now, if you wish to listen to it all again. It's been fantastic. Natasha, have you enjoyed your return to the midweek drives?
Oh, it's been wonderful, Alex. Thank you for having me.
It's one of the next critical questions. I mean, you've already demonstrated that you're an expert in terms of travel, an expert in language teaching, and indeed an expert in the rugby fortunes of the whole planet and England as well from that point of view. Will you be back with us again soon? Shall we do this again in the very near future?
Yeah, that would be lovely.
Let's get that sorted through and worked through. What should we actually say? Congratulations just for that, for A-level results, or even if you haven't done any A-levels, should that be a useful way to just sort of say farewell, just congratulations? I think so, probably. All right, so a 1, 2, 3, whatever your results, we would say from the midweek drive, quite heartily,
congratulations.
Casablanca, back row of the drive-in show in the flickering light, popcorn and cokes beneath the stars became champagne and caviar, making love on a long hot summer's night. I thought you fell in love in Casablanca, holding hands in the paddle fans in Rick's candlelit cafe, hiding in the shadows from the spies, Moroccan moonlight in your eyes, making magic at the movies in my old Chevrolet. Ooh, a kiss is still Casablanca, but a kiss is not a kiss without your side. Please come back to me in Casablanca. I love you more and more each day as time goes by. each day. As time goes by,